Hey friends, it's James Steensma, and welcome to the second episode of The Art of Letting Go. The show is designed to help not only you, but me, understand those things that we're not in control of, and how to finally get rid of them once and for all. But to do that, sometimes we have to talk our way through them. So join me, will you, right now, for The Art of Letting Go. Okay, so recapping our very first episode, the last episode, I introduced myself to you by letting you know that I am an emotional addict, but that emotional addiction comes from my time as a chemically dependent addict as well. I was addicted to painkillers prescribed to me after a surgery, which has totally changed the face of my existence. But it wasn't the only surgery that I've ever had that changed the way that I function. However, for us to get to that moment, we have to go back and revisit the rest of the story about my ileostomy, about my chemical dependency on OxyContin, and how we tried to move past it, not only emotionally, but physically. So that's going to be our jump off point today. And my hope is by the end of the episode, you will get an idea, as much as I will, about why it's so hard to let go of experiences like that. But again, that's the point of the show. So there are days in our lives and dates that have more significance than others, even though if we were to live our lives right, we would, as Tim McGraw suggests, live like we were dying. It's good advice, but most of us don't do it. So we collect days. And in my life, I have certain dates and days. August 13th is my wedding anniversary. May 12th and September 2nd and October 18th. Those are the days that my boys were born, not necessarily in order. But there are other days that stand out for significant reasons. And for me, there is a day that seems to pop up more times than not as being a day where my life changes, not just a little, but dramatically, and that is July 24th. July 24th, 2012, was the day that I decided I wanted to have my permanent ileostomy placed. Now, notice I say decided. It really wasn't a choice. All that I had control over was when I wanted to have it done, and the longer I waited, the better the chance of me not moving up the transplant list for my liver would be. I didn't have to do it July 24th. I could have done it in August. I could have done it in September. I could have done it in April, whenever I wanted to do it. But for whatever reason, my wife and I chose to do July 24th. It was not the first time that that date had changed my life, and it certainly would not be the last. July 24. So we'll come back to that date, that day, later. On this particular day, July 24th, 2012, I received my second ileostomy. In the first episode of The Art of Letting Go, I shared with you why I had to get that ostomy. And I shared with you that coming out of that ostomy surgery, I had an addiction or a dependency, a heavy dependency on OxyContin. To review why that happened, again, I have to be completely vulnerable and I have to admit that I don't want to, nor will I ever embellish my story. Again, I really don't have to. But to do so minimizes the importance of other people in my life. And it makes it seem as though the overcoming that happened then, along with the overcoming that I'm still struggling to get through now, is something of my own doing, where I recognize that the best way to overcome is to have those people around you who support you, who love you, who only want the best for you. And sometimes they say and do things that seems counter to that, because they might know better for me than I know for myself. And let me tell you, that is certainly true if you all had the opportunity to meet my inner circle. So coming out of that surgery, immediately, I went from, for pain management purposes, for my primary sclerosing cholangitis, PSC, using 5 milligrams of OxyContin per week. Coming out of the ileostomy surgery, I was placed on a regimen of going home with 10 milligrams every 3 hours. And to not do that medication the way it was prescribed would have, in essence, been breaking my own code of following doctor's orders until such instructions were complete. Well, again, just to revisit for a moment, the severity of the ability to get addicted to OxyContin, it's as, if not more addictive than heroin. Understand this. This is a legal drug that we have here in America. And certainly, I'm sure they have it other places. We've seen a huge crackdown on how often you can get prescribed this medication and how often you can get that prescription filled. That's a healthy thing that has come from understanding how addictive it has. But it certainly didn't help me in the moment. Now, in this episode, I want to be blunt. I want to be real. And I want to show you the inside story, if you will, one that I've hidden away from most everyone. And most likely there are less than a handful of people who know my story of addiction. And there's varying shades, understand this, of addiction. Mine may have looked more like a dependency, because I want you to understand the power of OxyContin. So, pain is a funny thing. We all have our own level of pain. We all have our own ways of dealing with it. And in some cases, people choose other legal ways to do it. Some people choose illegal ways to do it. I really wasn't a drinker. I had, as most kids do, a college experience. But understanding the outcome to that and knowing that I really didn't know what came next, I didn't drink again, not for many years. So we'll kind of leave that story where it is, as I smile through the microphone. Needless to say, alcohol was not a drug for me. I never smoked marijuana. I never smoked cigarettes. My vice, if you will, is cigars, something that me and my closest friends started doing when we were 18. You're probably on the other end saying, ooh, gross, but you know, it's fun. There's nothing like a group of people sitting around smoking a cigar and solving the world's problems. It's cathartic. And so I enjoy a good cigar from time to time, kill a guy. Nonetheless, the addiction to OxyContin was a bit of a surprise, although I really don't know why I was surprised. Quite frankly, I probably wasn't surprised because I didn't take the time to be surprised. I was too busy trying to maintain being pain-free. And OxyContin provides that. See, if our brain is convincing us that we are no longer in pain, we, of course, want to maintain that if you will, sobriety from pain. We want to feel pain-free. This is where the danger of OxyContin comes in. Because if I'm in pain, and I was, and I take OxyContin and it removes the pain, it's not that I feel like Superman or anything like that, but I feel pain-free. Follow? I don't feel high. I feel pain-free. And when you're pain-free, you will do everything you can to remain pain-free. This is logic. I'm not sure I know too many sadomasochists out there who derive joy from pain, not in any healthy way. I certainly didn't. But having lived with pain from the age of 14, there's a certain baseline that would probably floor most people, and that's my everyday. And you know, wonderfully, beautifully, I know people who have a higher pain threshold than I do, which is amazing to me. And it makes me question why. Why do they have the ability to maintain sobriety against pain? It's amazing. But I know mine, and I know mine well enough that in that moment, in those months or weeks rather, following my surgery, I needed that OxyContin. Or this is what my brain told me. Because I was pain-free for the first time since I was a teenager at the age of, I believe, 42, 41, I was pain-free. So I wanted to remain pain-free. That's the trick of OxyContin. So the reason why you see OxyContin as an evil is the same reason that people like myself can see it as a lifesaver. Because if you're not in pain and you take that pill, you will be high. Naturally. If you're not in pain and that's a pill that you choose to take, you are going to have the consequence of being high. And when you come down from that high, again, knowing that it's as bad as heroin, you need to remain high. And that's where we see pharmacies being robbed, or we see people taking dad's or mom's medication or grandma's medication because they have to remain high. Because the idea of functioning in a world without OxyContin becomes foreign to them. That was not the original goal of my doctor, certainly. My doctor is a salt of the earth man, and I would trust him all over again to prescribe such a medication, but there would have to be parameters. Because for me, I love the idea of being pain-free. Amen and hallelujah. But I needed it. My brain told me I needed it. My brain told me that every 3 hours I was going to be in pain again. And so it becomes a fool's errand to try to stay in front of the pain. And then instead of it being 3 hours, well, maybe, you know, I should do it around 2 hours and 45 minutes. Because I can start to tell that it's wearing off. And that's how the dependency and ultimately the addiction starts. But that's not when I discovered it. Weeks into my recovery, I felt good enough to start going back to work. And so I really worked hard to do that. In every surgery, it's always been a goal of mine to get back to work as soon as possible. That's probably taken years off my life. Ultimately, I guess I'll never know. But I like working. Isn't that horrible? I actually like working. So I wanted to get back to work. But I wasn't cleared yet by the doctor because I was still taking medications, my wounds, my incisions had not been healing properly, and the like. Nothing uncommon. But I remember as I was drawing closer to that day, I was still taking OxyContin at this exorbitant rate. And by this point, not only had I not cared about food, I probably didn't care an awful lot about hygiene. Because I really wasn't in that much pain anymore. It's nearly inconceivable to have been in the same pain that I was coming out of surgery or coming home from the hospital as I was 4 weeks later. I would have been back in the hospital had the pain been that severe. This all makes sense. Well, I remember distinctly that my wife and I, we were going to go to a family function. I was allowed to go out. I had been cleared to drive, believe it or not. But my wife was going to drive, and I really wasn't in a big hurry. And my wife is a stickler for time. That may be a male-female thing. That may be a type A versus type B, because let me tell you, I'm a type B. Please don't try to change me. It won't work. But I remember that I had to change my ostomy equipment. And that's a process. That's a process. I've watched videos of people do it in 5 minutes flat, and I want to slap them because for me, it's 30 minutes. And that's on a good day. On a bad day, it can be up to 2 hours because I have to shower and I'm waiting for my ostomy to cooperate. I'll let you figure out what that means. And on this particular day, I had to get in the shower, and I did. I rushed along because I knew that this was important to my wife. But when I got out of the shower and I had my equipment on, my fresh equipment that will last me all of 2 to 4 days, I couldn't find my OxyContin. And I knew that if I was going to somehow manage to get through this family function, I needed to take my pill ahead of time because the idea that pain might happen while I'm at the function, well, that was inconceivable. And quite frankly, if I was on OxyContin, I was probably a much cooler person to be around. But I couldn't find it. I couldn't find it. And so I got mad. I got so mad that I'm screaming at my wife, who didn't deserve that. And I accused her of taking it from me. And I demanded, I would not allow us to leave. I demanded that she help me find the OxyContin. We were not going to leave, I said, until you helped me find it, since you were the one who lost it. And understand, this is the OxyContin talking. This was not me. And my wife had learned this type of stuff. And again, as we'll talk about later, it wasn't the only time that she had to unfortunately learn that addiction or disease has a strange way of making somebody you love seem absolutely intolerable because they're out of their mind, quite literally. And on this particular day, I was. On this particular day, I needed my OxyContin so bad, or I believed I needed it so bad, that I asked my wife, no, I take that back. I demanded that my wife start helping me dig through the trash. Only since I had accused her of getting rid of my OxyContin, that somehow she was the one who was taking it from me because she probably recognized something in me I didn't recognize in myself, then she was going to be the one who was going to dig through the trash, including my ostomy waste, the bags and the pouches and the stickers and the glues and the powders that I would use to change my ostomy gear, dirtied and soiled. I asked her to start ripping open those bags and help me find it. And it was in that moment that it occurred to me that I was asking this person who has done nothing but love me to do the most egregious things that I could possibly think of, that I wouldn't ask my worst enemy to do for me, or force them to do for me. And so these things that I asked her to do to help me in my addiction were actually the exact things that helped me understand that an addiction existed. And again, even she will say, I don't know if you were truly addicted or if you were dependent. But let me tell you, again, having worked with people with addictions, when you see it in somebody else and it reminds you of yourself, it's likely that there's an addiction. That's my opinion. But maybe that helps you too. Are you seeing those same behaviors in yourself that you see in others? I did. And even though in that moment and on that day, I was still, if you will, too high, even though I was at a completely different baseline than somebody who's high, I was pain-free. But in being pain-free, that pill was causing me to be high. And I hope that makes sense. So my being controlled by this narcotic, this dangerous, dangerous narcotic, I asked my wife to dig through, and I'll forgive anyone who needs to excuse themselves for a moment while I say this, but I asked my wife to dig through shit. I want you to let that sink in. Now, no, that's not me. My wife knows that's not me. I know that's not me. But OxyContin doesn't know that's me. And it doesn't care. The doctor didn't know. But soon after they did. Soon after that, after all the apologies could be said, and by the way, I hid the OxyContin from myself. I put it in a drawer where I wouldn't put my medications normally because I already realized I needed it out of my life. My wife didn't hide it from me. I hid it from myself. But yet for 30 minutes, I forced this woman who loves me to run around our house and dig through trash to feed my addiction. That's messed up. That's not right. And so in the following days, I had to admit to myself that, first of all, a problem existed. And we called my doctor, our local doctor, who had just as much ability to control my intake of that medication as my specialist. And I said, I need this medication out of my life. I need it out of my life. It's ruining the one relationship that matters most. And the answer was actually very surprising. The answer was no. The answer was, I cannot remove that medication from your life, as you request, because there are no other options. The other option doesn't work well for you. Well, I don't like to be told no. Are you like that? I hate to be told no. It's about the same as my other major pet peeve, which is walking away from me while I'm talking to you. If you want to see me turn red, do one of those two things. So I don't like to be told no. And when a doctor tells me no, I'm going to say, proverbially, hold my beer. Right? I'm going to say, no, I'll prove to you that I don't want this drug by not taking this drug. Oh, that's not a good idea. But I did it anyway. I so badly wanted OxyContin out of my life that I chose to stop taking it immediately. There's a reason that doctors prescribe medications for a certain amount of time, and they tell you, make sure to finish this medication until the very end. OxyContin is dangerous on its own merits, but never go cold turkey. I did. And within days, no, scratch that. Within a day, the withdrawal symptoms were so terrifying. By this point, I had decided to return to work, by the way. And I returned to work. And I can remember distinctly that the withdrawing happened at work. It started to happen while I was at work. And I removed myself. It was a three-man crew that night. And I removed myself and I went into a quieter part of our building and I sat underneath a table and I called my wife. And I said, I need to come home. And so I went home. And then another day, shortly after, my brother, my older brother, Chip, by the way, I've not introduced you to my brothers, Chip and Joe, my sisters, Michelle and Valerie. Chip came over. And I was still, if you will, withdrawing. And he recognized it in me. He knew something was up. And I had shared this concern with him. And again, at that time, I proceeded. I was not going to seek professional help because I felt like I've sought professional help and professional help let me down. It took about a week, maybe a little bit longer before chemically I was over that. But let me tell you, it's been over 8 years. And emotionally, I still struggle with the effects of the addiction from OxyContin. Because I cannot seem to let go of what it made me do to other people. The guilt behind those actions, that even though my words of I'm sorry were met with, I understand, I know it's not you, I know it's the drugs talking, I forgive you. In those moments immediately following, of course I let it go. It felt good to be forgiven. It felt good to apologize. But over time, as minds have a tendency to do, especially idle minds, I start remembering back to those major screw-ups in my life, but especially the ones that are dominant screw-ups. And this is a dominant one for me. This one changed the face of our relationship. Thus, it changed the relationship of my life. Now, my wife has forgiven me for many things over the years and probably has a different understanding of this situation than I do, but it was that moment where I felt a tidal shift in how I live my life, but also that I have a problem of letting things go. In real time, I had a problem of letting go of that pill or letting go of blaming her for taking my medication, of bringing it up repeatedly, of saying things like, you're the one who lost it, you need to be the one who found it. instead of letting go of that and understanding that the reality may be something completely different. And this is, once again, when we stack these things that are hard to let go of, because they define us in certain ways, when we stack those on top of one another, we have this this almost impossible journal of events, that digging through them one at a time seems fruitless, seems pointless. Yet I understand it's what we have to do. And so what are those things for you that we have to peel back one page at a time, or like an onion, one layer at a time, to get to the root? What is it that keeps us from letting go? What is it in this event of my addiction, my dependencies on chemicals to feel better about myself, what is it about that event that keeps me from letting go? That if all things being equal, I've apologized and the apology was accepted, why do I still feel guilt? What is it in those things that you do in your own life that cause such guilt? Let's unpack that next time. Let's flip the script and see what we can do to unpack your guilt. And then by unpacking it, finally let it go. Thanks for joining me. I'm James Steensma, and this is The Art of Letting Go. Hey friends, it's James. I want to reiterate for you how dangerous it was for me to try to come clean by myself. Please don't do that. There are so many resources out there that can help people who are struggling with addiction. But the first step is to acknowledge it. But do seek help and don't do it alone. Contact the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration at 1-800-662-HELP. That's 1-800-662-4357. Or go to their website, samhsa.gov. Do not do it alone. Remember, always, you can contact the crisis text line at 741-741. You just simply type in those six digits, send it, and a crisis counselor will be right there with you, texting back and forth so that you can stay positive in faces of depression, anxiety, or again, addiction. But acknowledgement is the first key to success. Do not do it alone. Reach out to either the National Helpline from samhsa.gov or the Crisis Text Line. Until next time, I'm James Steensma, and this is The Art of Letting Go.